transgender people don't live here.
I've never met anyone who's transgender.
I swear I don't know someone who's transgender.
Transgender and non-binary people like me hear this all the time.
But according to the HRC Foundation, there are more than 2 million transgender people in the United States.
We live in every community across this country.
You might be surprised to hear that there are more transgender and non-binary people in the United States than there are
Starbucks, McDonald's, and Walmart locations combined.
In fact, if you put us all together,
there'd be more non-binary and transgender folks than the populations of DC,
or Nebraska,
or Maine,
or Idaho,
or West Virginia.
As a matter of fact, 15 states have a lower population than the amount of trans folks in the US.
So here are a few things to keep in mind.
You don't always know when a person is trans.
But we're your neighbors,
your coworkers,
your students,
your customers,
and even your friends and family.
We exist in every culture, todas las culturas, throughout human history.
And while we're more visible than ever before,
sometimes you just don't see us.
So when you hear about politicians pushing for discriminatory bills,
know this, these bills address problems that aren't even real.
Problems that don't actually exist.
But we do.
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 And we need your support.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website, kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend meetings are available on the website. The Finance Committee will meet on Thursday, August 18th at 5:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland Tycho Farm Fest on Sunday, August 28th from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Triskley Farm in West Lynn. Portland Tycho blends traditional Japanese taiko drumming with dynamic choreography and storytelling. That's Portland Tycho Farm Fest on Sunday, August 28th from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Triskley Farm, 29700 Southwest Mountain Road in West Lynn. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Episode
What's up, y'all? It's your homegirl Mystic, and you are now listening to Hard Knock Radio, my favorite station, for real.
What up, though? This is Merce of the Living Legends, and you're checking out Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop.
This is Medusa, rocking it through and through for the ladies. All my gangster goddesses stand strong on Hard Knock Radio.
Yo, test. This is Charlie Tuna from Jurassic 5 MCs on Hard Knock Radio.
Davy D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon as we head towards what many are predicting to be a landmark election. With all that is at stake, with all the voter suppression laws that have been passed around the country, with the hearings around January 6th and the FBI raiding the homes of the former president and in the state of Florida, you know, citizens who have been very active in their work. We're talking about the Uhuru movement. We wanted to find out what is going on with voting rights and how the political landscape is shaping up. And we're doing a series where we're looking at various states. And this afternoon, we want to talk about Florida. Joining us is a person who heads one of the most impactful voting engagement organizations. It is Faith in Florida. And so joining us is Reverend Rhonda Thomas. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you this morning?
Good. So, you know, where we're at here in the West Coast, Florida is an enigma. It always comes up in the news, and I don't think for people like yourself, it's always for the right reasons. Governor Ron DeSantis is somebody who many people consider to be a threat. People are keeping their eyes out and the ears pierced. Some of the laws that have passed, the anti-CRT law and there's a woke law and all sorts of things that we've covered have been concerning, not just because of what's happening in Florida, but because it has the potential to set a precedent in other places. But you're in the belly of the beast and you've been doing this good work. So we wanted to hear from you, you know, what it's like, what are y'all doing, and, you know, what Faith in Florida has been up against.
Okay. Yeah, once again, all eyes are on Florida. And we do have a very, very interesting governor who have really, really created some interesting laws and bills that can definitely hurt and continue to suppress the voters, particularly Black and brown voters in the state of Florida. Faith in Florida, we cover 35 counties in the state. There are 67 counties in total, and we're present in 35 counties, including Miami-Dade County. That's like a state all by itself. Mm-hmm. And so, Faith in Florida, we've been on the ground. You know, early voting has begun. Every county is different. In Miami-Dade alone, we started early voting last week, Monday. Broward County, we started early voting on Saturday, which is the Broward County is the largest Democratic county in the entire state. So we always look for something interesting to take place there. But we're being extremely intentional by keeping focus on even some of our rural counties. However, one of the things that we've been, we have poll monitors out, and we've been extremely intentional by having poll monitors in certain precincts, because it was a bill that was passed that created a special police department. The special police department cost over $7 million. No one really actually know how this police department will literally interact with the voters. Not even our local police know how to they don't even know how to engage one another as far as law enforcement is concerned. But this special police department will be designated to monitor voting precincts, and if they should see where they think is any level of fraud, there will be an arrest made and a felony charge will take place. once again, I said, we really don't know if they're going to be in plain clothes. Are they officers in uniform? We have no idea. But what we've noticed is around the state that there are some unmarked black cars that is pulling up at our precincts. They're not getting out, but they're just backing in at various precincts across the state, sitting in their cars, windows up. And we're wondering, is this the new police department, voting police?
Wow. Let me ask you a question regarding that. I remember hearing about this secret, I'm going to call it a secret police, but it's not so secret, I guess, because you all know about it. But this police department that is monitoring the polls, they are going to arrest people and charge them with felonies. What raises a question for me is, do you get a felony if you show up and let's say you're Reverend, you know, Rhonda E. Thompson, but on the ballot it just says Reverend Rhonda Thompson, and you go up there and try to vote and they say, well, there's an E on your name and there's no E on the ballot, that's a fraudulent act? Do you get arrested for something like that, or are they looking for something more nefarious? Because as far as we've known, there hasn't been any rampant voting fraud in Florida. So it sounds like they have a police force that's looking for anything and everything to justify their existence.
You just answered your question. That's what it's, that's exactly what it is. We have never known the details of what they would see voting fraud, how it should look in their eyesight. We've questioned that and never received an answer. So we're thinking just what you just named, because they do, I do know that it was quoted that he has, something has to happen so voters and can see where this $7.5 million is actually going. So we're expecting something as simple as, yeah, you don't have an E on your your voter registration, but yet you signed an E or the opposite. So we are looking for, that's why we're being extremely intentional by having poll monitors, because someone has to watch the new police department. It's very easy to get a felony charge in the state of Florida. Now, that is extremely easy. You let helium balloons go up in the air, and that's a felony charge.
Really?
Oh, yes. It's very easy to get a felony in the state of Florida. So, if you throw a rock at a duck, you know, it's extremely easy. So this, with this voting fraud, you know, when we look at voting fraud, the largest area of what we thought was voting fraud, and it's not across the state, but in particular counties like Miami-Dade, is dead people voting.
People, right.
Yeah, you know, that was the biggest fraud that we've seen that has been noticeable, but that has been decreased since 2018, those numbers. So we, and then also in 2020 and 2018, the same governor thought that Florida was the perfect example of having great elections with little problems. And last year, well, this year, he saw different. And so we don't know what happened to that great reputation that he saw as being Florida being a perfect example of, and all of a sudden it changed.
Reverend Rhonda Thomas from Florida in Faith, let me ask you this. What is the reaction to some of this political shenanigans that you just described? And what I mean by that, you know, having my father, my late father, lived in Florida, so I'm a little familiar, at least with Dade and Broward County and all that. It's a very large, you know, black and brown population who, in theory, should be totally opposed to many of the laws that have been passed. The question is, how does somebody like DeSantos get into office? Are we talking about people who have one set of realities versus people who have another set? Or are we looking at a scenario where a large number of people who are eligible to vote who just aren't showing up? Because I've always sensed that the majority of people in Florida are people who look like me and you and others who have often been marginalized and excluded, but we just don't go in record numbers. What say you on that in this particular case?
It's a number of reasons, and you really pointed out some great stuff. First of all, Florida is, because it's so huge, every county looks extremely different, even the way we vote. Yes, it has, Florida is really, consists of a lot of black and brown folks and black and brown voters. Number one, what we found out as an organization, Faith in Florida, it was very few people even understood or knew about the new legislation that was passed. So we had to do a lot of work, and when I say a lot of work, we still haven't even put a dent in it because of a lack of capacity to get that educational piece out of, this is what passed through legislation, and this is how black and brown voters will be impacted. And then when you look at a county like Miami-Dade County, which is extremely diverse, and so the voter turnout has always been good, but when you look at the Cuban population, who normally vote in ways that support some of the laws and bills that DeSantis passed, that becomes extremely interesting in the way we get out to vote and what we vote for and who we vote for. DeSantis lost, I mean, he won by a very, very small
margin.
Number, right. It was very, very small. And then the redistricting maps that was created by our legislators, and then he vetoed that and redrew his own maps, have become a huge problem for the state because voters was not even aware that the maps have been it was vetoed, and that he personally drew his own maps. So that has been a problem in a way of, is once again, we need to educate the people that you need to know exactly where you're going to vote. Take advantage of early voting because, you know, during early voting, you can vote at any precinct in your county. So we have lost quite a bit of black representation with our legislators because of the redrawing of the maps, which we think is extremely strategic. And so we were trying to get that information out as well. And then overall across the state, unfortunately, it has been a low voting turnout across the state. And when we're knocking on the doors and canvassing and phone banking, it's because people are really so tired of not thinking that their vote is being counted because of all of the voter suppression laws that are consistently being built. You look at a county as large as Broward County, we only have two areas where you can literally use the drop box. Wow. And it's not the supervisor of election. The supervisor is not our problem. It's the state that's our problem.
You know, to me, it's obvious that the plan of action is to win by attrition, you know, just cause so much confusion that people throw up their hands and walk away. Is there anything that can really motivate people who are feeling that frustration and just, you know, want to toss their hands up. I mean, how are people able to cope, for example, with all these repressive rules that are passed in Florida? Or if people just said, you know, that's just the way it is, and, you know, just put their heads down and just keep, you know, go about, you know, trying to survive? Or is there a linchpin that can really get people activated, excited, or angry enough to come to the polls? According to some of the recent polls, it says that, you know, those who have left-leaning positions are leading, but the excitement is clearly in folks who lean conservative. They're feeling motivated, like, yep, we get to really repress and oppress these people, and that's what we're going to do, and they're excited about it. What's the linchpin to counter that?
Believe it or not, we're still in the room of strategizing on how do we even create conversation pieces to fit a variety of groups. Mm-hmm. When you look at older Black voters, nothing sways them. They're going to get out and vote.
Right.
They don't trust the mail system. They don't care if my 87-year-old dad is going to vote today, and I'm like, well, do you want to, you know, drop it in the drop box, or would you like to put it in the mail? And he's like, nope.
I want to go straight to the poll.
I'm going to the poll. I'm going to stand. My children to take shifts to stand with me if the lines are long. And he has this thing where if I'm going to die, I'll die voting. So we have that, our older Black voters who just stand on, they'll stand in the rain and won't be swayed. Then our young voters, our millennials and our Gen Zs, it takes a little more work and a little more talking to and really, really trying to get them to understand this right to vote, what all it took for us to vote, and that we trust and depend on them to carry this mantle where their children, because when I look at Florida and the laws that have been created, we're so close to a bloody Sunday. It's unbelievable. We're to the point where we're about to repeat what took place in Selma, Alabama, if we're not staying woke.
Wow. And so you feel that sort of tension and the potential for violence.
Definitely. Definitely. In 2020, now I do want to make comment that we've been doing an analysis on voter turnout from 2010 all the way up to the present. And 2018 really, really landed a mark in the state of Florida. Because we had two valuable things on the ballot. Amendment 4, where we were fighting for over 1.5 million returning citizens to get their voting rights restored. Brought people to the polls, as well as the potentials of having the first Black man, Andrew Gillum, to be the governor of Florida. That also drew people to the polls. 2020 drew people to the polls because we was just sick and tired of being sick and tired. However, we did experience some racial tension in certain areas. For example, in Broward County, at one precinct, you got 20 white men that came to the polls with bats. Now, I'm not sure what they thought they were gonna do with those bats, but the fact that they came to the precincts, and I personally had to call Broward County Police Department, and they're questioning me, Reverend, are you sure that they're not using these bats for canes because they may have a disability?
Wow.
And I had to really be clear. If it was a Black man out there with 20 Black men out there with bats, would you ask me that same stupid question? And so we were able to get over 20 clergy to monitor that particular poll 7 a.m. from the time it opened until it closed, to make sure that it would be no unnecessary tension or drama that would take place. So we have always, in Miami-Dade, we had a police. You know, police cannot go to a precinct unless they've been called.
Right.
You just don't go because that's going to be your new hangout spot. And so it's different things like that that has brought tension across the state at various precincts, that we have to have poll monitors to monitor the polls, just like as if we were law enforcement, just to make sure that Black and brown voters have the best voting experience they can possibly have.
Reverend Rhonda Thomas, you know, Faith in Florida is connected to, you know, larger organizations like your Faith in Actions and all that. So there are these strong church networks that have been doing that hard and heavy lifting all over. One of the things that we've seen is people who are not engaged in elections coming into other states to help with the monitoring. That's one, and I wanted to see if that practice is continuing. And two, considering the level of oppression, especially with a secret police department that is not made clear what they're looking for and what the rules are and what the rules aren't, do you tap into an international community the way that many of us have been asked to go to various countries? I know I have. Can you do some poll monitoring over here in this country? You know, I think the Philippines is a good place, you know, where people are looking for international observers. Does Florida need international observers? You know, whether it's supplied by the UN or people of goodwill from other places coming to watch and see what's going on with these polls and the elections.
Since I've never really noticed or anything has been brought to my attention where we've had people to monitor the polls from another country, I've never even thought about it, to be completely honest with you, because of the way, depending on what area you're in Florida, we can be extremely overprotected. When you look at areas like Miami-Dade, Broward, Palm Beach, Orange County, which is Orlando, we know who's who. So to interact or engage with someone from international, out of the country coming in to monitor our polls, I think it would be extremely difficult for them. However, I do think that in rural areas, it's been known for people that come from out of the state who is probably trying to monitor the polls based on a party. That is more known. Because even during, like I say, for example, our presidential elections, when different parties, they just allocate people to go all across the country and getting people out to vote. Florida is a very, very overprotected kind of territorial state. Yeah, like, oh no, you're not from here.
Yeah.
And so we're giving you limited information, and more than likely we're not going to follow you either. So and so this is what we have noticed with different parties that say, wow, Florida is a hard state. And it is. So Faith in Florida, we've been blessed in a way because we have close to a little over 900 congregations across the state, multiracial, multi-faith, that really, really come together.
Right.
When it comes to any civic engagement and getting out to vote. So we've been really, really blessed in that area. But it's still, I don't care how large we grow, is still so many people we can't reach in educating them and bringing that awareness that these laws exist.
Reverend Thomas, if we're getting ready to wrap up, one of the interesting phenomenons we saw, I want to say sometime last year, was the push to get the John Lewis Act and other, you know, voting encouragement acts passed through, voting rights acts passed through. we saw a lot of black folks, black organizations, black Greek letter organization, black civic organizations, organizations like your own. And the question was raised that black folks ain't the only ones being oppressed in this election, that they have targeted younger groups, they've targeted other ethnicities. In Florida, for example, you have, you know, a left-leaning Jewish population that found themselves on the receiving end of a lot of this, you know, upheaval. What are some of these other groups doing? Are they coming out and are they taking this? Are they concerned in the same way that black folks have been concerned based upon the history?
In Florida, we have a variety of organizations, especially now, because our governor have attacked so many people. We have organizations that represent the LGBTQ community because the law, the bill that was passed, we can't say gay, and how it's impacting children through our public education system. We do have, even with women in the Roe versus Wade, women of all walks of life are out there. And then with our Jewish community, they're out there. Immigrant communities, black and brown, are out there because they too find themselves being impacted by voter suppression. For example, you know, Faith in Florida has been extremely intentional by including our black immigrant community who has been left out, not acknowledged. It's more so the brown immigrant community that is always lifted up and how they're being oppressed and suppressed. So I do see a variety. I do, at the same time, I still have a concern that it's not enough organizations that's being able to literally reach in having deeper conversation and listening when it comes to young people and black men. We noticed that the voter turnout with black men was extremely low. So we started some listening sessions just trying to see what's going on, why it's going on. And so those are some areas that we struggle with, that we're still working on how do we reach them. We definitely, during our voting seasons, have influencers that come in that can engage and see where young people actually respond. Mm-hmm. Because it's going to take all of that. You know, it was a time where the church can really lead this effort. Right. But right now, the church needs some help in helping lead this effort and getting people out to vote. We did just before I close, we did analysis in the state of Florida of how many active voters, how many non-active voters, and how many voters have been dropped because they had not voted in the last three election seasons and they're not even aware of it.
Wow. And yeah. So, and if they show up and they vote and blah, 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 that could potentially land them with a felony charge.
Definitely. Well, if they show up, they're going to find out that they're not able to vote.
Okay.
And unfortunately, they won't know until we're doing phone banking and calling voters that have been dropped and voters that if you don't go vote this election cycle, you will be dropped.
Okay. Last question. The races that are going on, I know you had Souls to the Polls over this weekend. People are doing early voting, but that's to set up for the November election, if I'm correct. And they say that there may be a close race for Mark Rubio's seat. That's what we're hearing. But you know, what is some of those key races look like from your standpoint?
Well, for us across the state, we do have that congressional seat with Rubio and Val Demings, which they're running neck to neck.
Senatorial seat.
Yes, right. the Senate seat. All of our state legislators have to run again, whether their term was up or not, because of the redrawing of the redistricting maps. So they must run again. They don't have a choice. So those seats are extremely important because we've lost, we will lose seats based on Black representation, based on the redrawing and the redistricting. That's important for us. And then our local races with commissioners is huge for us. So we have our local races across the state, that's huge. And our legislative seats, and definitely that one congressional seat. And then we do have a governor's race, which is becoming quite interesting in whether, you know, who the nominee will be.
Well, we will keep our eyes and ears peeled. Reverend Rhonda Thomas, thank you for joining us. We encourage people to go to the website, faithinflorida.org. Again, faithinflorida.org. Hopefully people can tap in and support you in the efforts that you guys are doing. You're doing that heavy lifting, and it shouldn't be taken for granted. We appreciate you.
Thank you. And our website is in three languages, English, Spanish, and Creole.
That's right.
So by all means, you should get some form of understanding.
There you go. We're going to take a break here. We'll be right back.
Hard Knock, Hard Knock, Hard Knock Radio. Hard Knock Radio. Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio. Hard Knock Radio. Davey D, Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. Wanted to talk to a good friend of the show. You know him, you love him. It is Tim Redman from 48 Hills. And Tim, we were just talking off air. It's been a minute, but so much has transpiring in San Francisco. Wanted to get your take on things and see if you could share things with the listeners. The big headline making news is the ousting of Chesa Boudin, the installment of Brooke Jenkins, and controversy around her appointment. Can you start to break that down? Because a lot of people thought, hey, crime was immediately going to go down in the city. This was going to be the be-all, end-all, and now we find ourselves quagmired in a crazy situation. So what exactly is going on?
Well, what's going on is the mayor, after Chesa Boudin was recalled, with a multi-million dollar campaign attacking him for a lot of things that he had nothing to do with, the mayor could have picked a seasoned, moderate, safe prosecutor who could have just kind of took over and run the office. But no, she made a political appointment. She chose Brooke Jenkins, who was in many ways the face of the recall campaign, and who has never managed anything. No management experience at all. And, you know, it was basically someone who she chose because it would be someone who would follow her politics. And in fact, when Brooke Jenkins went into the office for the first day and met with her staff, she had a mayoral aide at her side. It kind of felt like from the beginning, the mayor is monitoring her appointment to what is supposed to be an independent office. And then it turns out, well, for one thing, she only moved to the city like right during the recall campaign. So she hasn't been a San Francisco voter for very long. And then it turns out that she was paid more than $100,000 by an affiliate of the group that was working to recall Boudin. Right? And it gets a little complicated here. She said, oh, I quit my job and I volunteered to recall Chesa Boudin. It turns out she wasn't actually a volunteer. She was getting paid more than $100,000 for allegedly consulting work with the 501c4 political or the 501c3 nonprofit arm of the political organization that was working to recall Chesa Boudin. So already that starts to look a little funky.
Right. Right. Now, was she a prosecutor in the office prior to Boudin coming in?
Yeah, she was a prosecutor. And in fact, according to emails that she sent out, I mean, until she decided to quit and go after Boudin, she seemed to think he was doing a great job. She got mad because there was a case with a defendant who was very clearly mentally ill. Three psychiatrists testified. The guy clearly didn't know what he's doing. Thought his mother was a zombie from outer space and was, you know, tried to kill her because he thought. And Brooke Jenkins wanted him prosecuted and sent to prison, and wouldn't go for the fact that Boudin's office basically said, "This is by any standard a insanity defense. This is by any standard someone who should be getting mental health treatment instead of being incarcerated in a standard prison." So that was really the reason that she claims that she left, because she thought Boudin was being too soft on crime. Although that particular case, I mean, it's really hard for anyone from the outside to look at that and say, this is a person who should have been prosecuted as a, you know, as a sane person who clearly had mental health issues. But so then she starts, you know, she joins the oust Chesa campaign, and she had a very powerful argument. She said, hey, I used to work in the DA's office. I was a prosecutor. I had to quit because he didn't care about prosecuting crime. And this is the law that she put out. And she was on flyers, and she was, you know, talked on radio and TV and in the Chronicle, and, you know, was really one of the leaders of the campaign making that argument. We didn't.
But it
know.
Was being powered by outside forces.
Being powered by about $3 million in outside money, including a lot of it from this guy, Bill Oberndorf, who is a big supporter of Mitch McConnell.
Okay.
So it's like big out-of-town and GOP money. Now, we didn't know until she took office and had to file her economic disclosure forms that Bill Oberndorf's other organization that has the office in the same place in San Rafael and that uses some of the same people was paying her over $100,000 to do allegedly consulting work for this nonprofit, but also consulting work for big corporations on something about public safety, like, which is, no one says this is illegal. It's just kind of weird. And like doing consulting work for big corporations about safety in San Francisco is kind of weird and creepy. But the fact is no one knew about this. So it clearly looks like she was hiding something. She was hiding the fact that she was profiting off the campaign that she was supposedly volunteering for. Then she comes in and she starts firing people. And she's fired, I think at this point, 15 or more veteran prosecutors, some of them who had been hired by Chesa Boudin. And of course, one of the things she criticized him for was chaos in the office. All these people got fired. Well, she fired more people than he did. And, you know, what I'm hearing from inside that office is it's almost as if no one's in charge. She's never managed anything before. She doesn't know how to run the office. So it is kind of chaotic. Then she goes on and says that the biggest problem facing San Francisco is open air drug sales in the Tenderloin. And she's going to crack down and essentially launch a new war on drugs. And that is not a decision that can be justified with any criminological or law enforcement thing. It's purely a political decision. This is what the mayor wants to focus on right now.
Right.
Shut down the drug. And, you know, the problem with that is that, number one, you and I both know, it's never worked. It's a fundamentally racist. I mean, the war on drugs has been one of the most horrible racist policies in, you know, in modern U.S. history. Right. And besides, it doesn't work. Right? You're not busting low-level dealers is not going to clean up the Tenderloin, much less do anything about fentanyl overdoses.
Right.
Plus, we have the third problem, which is that there's no room in the jail for all these people. The jail is already understaffed and overcrowded, and we still have a COVID pandemic. So all of this like can't possibly work, and yet, so it's basically just a political move by the mayor's DA.
With that in mind, Tim, the reality is that I don't want to go to the city because car gets broken into.
Yep.
I don't want to walk around and see, you know, people ODing. There is that perception, right? I don't want to go to certain parts of the city that have been under siege. Those are words that, you know, you may hear from some of the people that were in the recall campaign, but that's a concern that's been voiced by people who are just visitors to the city and county of San Francisco. So there is this reaction, public reaction, that something needs to be done. Two things come to mind. One narrative said the police were dissatisfied with Boudin, so they did what we call not a sick out, but a slow out, right? They were just, you know, turning their head, you know, not doing things. And it seemed to be following a pattern that in almost every major city, you heard the same complaint. You can go to Houston, you can go to Atlanta, you could go to Minneapolis, you could go to New York City. It's all the same thing. Hey, this crime is out of control. The police are nowhere to be seen. All of them are saying that they were suffering from low morale. All of these departments saying that they're understaffed. Other of these people were blaming the defund movement, even in cities like Houston and Georgia, where it's against the law to even defund, to reduce the budget. So now the narrative is like, now the police are here, they're going to now button up and be back on the case. We're hearing that has not happened, or has that been happening? So what's been the perception? What's been the reality on the ground?
Yeah, no, I mean, that is in fact the perception that the recall campaign really tried to play off, right? It's unsafe to go to San Francisco, your car will get broken into. Well, a couple things about that. One is, car break-ins have been a huge problem in San Francisco for many years. Typically, before COVID, cars were broken into largely in tourist areas. Union right. Square, Fisherman's Wharf. The tourists would come to San Francisco. They would leave their suitcases, their backpacks, sometimes their electronics in the car. Someone would break in and steal them, right? Of course, under COVID, there were no tourists. So the people who did the car break-ins moved into the neighborhoods.
Right.
Now, but the thing to understand about that is, even before the police went on a slow out, and they did, I mean, there's no question, the cops didn't like Chesabuddin, in part because he was prosecuting cops for homicide and for excessive use of violence. They really didn't like this. So they basically stopped doing their jobs in many cases. Right? But even before that, San Francisco police solved less than 5% of car break-ins. Doesn't happen. And I think, you know, it's pretty easy to understand why. Car break-ins happen really, really fast. The people who break in very rarely leave any evidence behind. Right? And, you know, the cops in San Francisco don't even show up for a car break-in. They ask you to go online and fill out a form so that you can claim your insurance.
So this was before Chesa was in office. This was before Chesa was in office.
You know, you call, and you know, the tourists would call the police, my car's been broken into, and they'd say, well, we don't respond to car break-ins. Just go online and fill out this form, and we'll give you a case number to give your insurance company. That's it. They don't solve car break-ins, right? There's been a lot, in my neighborhood in Bernal Heights, there's been a lot of catalytic converter thefts.
Right.
People crawl under your car in the middle of the night, cut off the catalytic converter, and take it and sell it for its parts, for the metals in it. Okay. Again, very, very hard to solve unless there happens to be a cop driving by at the time, right?
Right.
So the idea that, wow, suddenly car break-ins are going to end in San Francisco because we have a new DA. The DA can't prosecute a car break-in unless the police make an arrest. Right? Now, are the police going to start going and doing massive buy bust operations in the Tenderloin and arresting low-level dealers? They will. So that's what the mayor wants to see. And then what's going to happen is, after those people are arrested, they'll be released from jail fairly quickly because we don't have a place for them in the county jail. And because judges, not the DA, not the cops, judges are less likely now to hold people on minor crimes, nonviolent crimes, and demand high cash bail. They're going to be back out on the streets again, or someone else will. Some of these drug dealers, by the way, some of the folks, the low-level dealers in the Tenderloin, are themselves crime victims. I mean, some of them are basically trafficked. They're brought in, particularly from Honduras, and told that this is what you have to do to survive.
Right.
And you know, the reason that Chesabuddin wasn't charging them with drug sales but with accessory is because that's not a deportable offense. So basically what Brooke Jenkins is talking about now is having people arrested for small-time drug sales and then deported. Because if you charge them with drug dealing of any sort and they get a conviction, that's a deportable offense. So, and now we've got even more people clogging up ICE, right? And in another jail waiting to be deported. So that's the politics of what's going on. The mayor wants to see action and wants to fight the perception that you were just talking about, but a lot of that is obviously much deeper socioeconomic problems that are not going to be solved just by arresting people.
One of the cases that made headlines under Bodine was finding like one of the owners of Quickly, a fast food place,
yep,
was fronting as a fencing operation.
Yep.
And at the time, I think you came on and it was discussed that the SFPD did not want to work with Bodine on it, so he had to bring in federal officials to do the arrest.
And had to rent a truck to collect all the stolen merchandise because the cops wouldn't do it.
Brooke Jenkins said that, well, not her, I think one of the police said that they were going to start going after the fencing operations behind the catalytic converters and all those things. Is this something that SFPD could have been doing but just didn't do, or is there been some new developments, or is this just another political ploy that may or may not work?
Well, there's no question that SFPD could have been doing that in the past. All right. And in fact, when Bodine was DA, one of the things that he said repeatedly is, I don't want somebody selling a quarter gram of drugs on the street. I want the guy with 30 kilos of fentanyl, right? I don't want the small-time car break-in. I want the guy who's fencing 5,000 stolen catalytic converters.
Like the people they found in San Rafael and the company they found in Fremont most recently.
Right. And this is what Bodine said all along, is these are the cases he wants to prosecute because that's how you actually make a difference. Right. I mean, the reason that people steal catalytic converters is they can get $500 for them from a fence. That's why people do it. It's an easy $500, right? Or that, whatever it is. It takes you 15 minutes. You cut it with a torch. You bring it in, and then there's someone who will buy it from you. And if that person who will buy it from you isn't there, then people stop stealing catalytic converters because there's no money in it, right? So this is something the cops could have been doing all along, right? It requires a little work. It requires a little investigative work. And if the investigators in the district attorney's office could find the guy at the boba shop, you'd think the cops would be able to do that too.
Right.
So this is something that SFPD, you know, honestly, SFPD has a long history of not doing good investigative work. I mean, the homicide clearance rate in San Francisco has always been low, particularly by national standards. That, you know, I remember once when A.C. Thompson and I were working together at the Bay Guardian. This is way prior to Bodine. A.C. was looking at a murder case where a guy who was a biker got murdered, and the cops really didn't care because they thought he was just a lowlife anyway. And A.C. starts looking into it and actually finds the guy who did it.
Wow.
Right? And we went together to see the homicide cops, and AC said, look, this guy is living in the East Bay and he's all but confessed to this crime. And the cops said to us, well, that's interesting. Have him give us a call sometime.
Wow.
That was their response. Not, where does he live? I'm going to go arrest him. Have him give us a call sometime. Right. So we've always had low clearance in crimes that require a lot of investigative work in San Francisco. And, you know, that's been the case with the car break-ins and the catalytic converter thefts and so many other things. And remember, you know, there were instances during the flood of Union Square break-ins and where the cops were there, saw people stealing stuff and didn't arrest anyone. There were cases where the cops were there, a cannabis dispensary was robbed while the cops were sitting out in front and they didn't do anything. Right? So, and then this all gets blamed on Chesa Bodine. So we will see. You know, the other important thing about this is that Jenkins is not running unopposed. That John Hamasaki, who was a very outspoken police commissioner and a critic of the chief demanding police reforms, has filed and is running for DA. And he already has kind of a lot of progressive support. And Joe Eliotto Veronese, whose mom, Angela Eliotto, was a supervisor, is also running for DA, kind of sort of to the right of Brooke Jenkins, even, you know, as an old-fashioned kind of law and order guy. So there's a real race this fall.
Wow.
And she may not win.
I was going to ask, what does the tea leaf say on that?
We don't know. I mean, already her office looks like there's already scandals and you know, chaos in her office. A lot of the things she criticized Bodine for. Hamasaki is a popular guy, particularly with progressives. He'll have a lot of the people who supported Bodine will support him. And I don't know, maybe on the west side of town in the more conservative areas, Joe Alioto Veronese will take votes away from Brooke Jenkins, and she gets caught in the middle. I don't know.
The Alioto name still has sway.
Still has some sway, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that's something to keep our eyes and ears out on there. You know, I was going to say, do you think the city has moved in a more positive direction overall, aside from the new DA, or are there just a lot of challenges that we're being distracted from?
Oh, no, we were being distracted from a lot of challenges. I mean, the biggest one, of course, is homelessness and housing, but right. also, like, no one's going back to work downtown.
Yeah.
Or very few people are. And we got all that office space downtown that's going to be empty for a long time. What are we going to do with that? How is that going to affect the city's business taxes? Right? The state is telling us that we have to build all of this new housing, but there's no money to do it. You know, developers who have been given permits to build housing aren't doing it because the return isn't high enough now and the costs are too high. All of these things are real crises that the mayor's office really hasn't been addressing while we're talking about drug dealing in the Tenderloin. And of course, on the crime front, there's also the problem that there have been a large number of assaults, some of them hate crimes, against Asians, particularly Asian seniors. And right. this is a really serious problem. And in the meantime, as I say, you know, the mayor's talking about drug dealers in the Tenderloin.
Well, we will keep our eyes and ears out on some of the things that we've been talking about. I almost called you Chaser, Tim Redmond. any other stories that we should be keeping our eyes and ears out that you all have been covering in 48 Hills?
Well, there's a lot. There's a board of supervisors race this fall in districts 2, 4, 6, 8, and 10. 6 is a very interesting race because that's the race where Matt Haney gave up his seat to go to the state assembly, and his chief of staff, Honey Mahogany, is challenging the incumbent Matt Dorsey, who was put in place by the mayor. Right. Matt Dorsey was formerly the communications director for SFPD.
Oh, wow.
In charge of what some people call a multi-million dollar propaganda campaign.
Right.
So that race is interesting. Gordon Maher has been a stalwart of the progressive movement in District 4. He's taking on a challenge from the right by a couple of candidates. And that, because of the redistricting mess that we've also talked about in San Francisco, that district is now more conservative.
Wow.
So all of this is happening. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of different stuff that's going to be on the ballot. There's the school board is up. The mayor appointed 3 members of the school board, one of whom almost immediately put out some incredibly racist stuff.
I heard that, very anti-Black stuff.
Very anti-Black yeah. stuff, basically blaming Black parents for Black kids not succeeding in school. And you know, hasn't really, I mean, she's apologized now, but now she's going to be on the ballot and she's right. got to face the voters. You know, so there's a lot. There's a slate of labor candidates running for the community college board, basically saying that the current board has been too willing to lay off teachers. There's just a lot going on in San Francisco.
Well, there you have it. Want to thank you this afternoon, Tim Redmond. Thank you for sharing your wisdom. Want to encourage everybody to check out all the stories you have on 48hills.org. We are going to bounce out for this afternoon. See you tomorrow.
Hard Knock Radio.
This is Roger Fisher from Heart. You're listening to 90.7 KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Tell your friends to listen on in and support the mass movement of the human tribe.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Portland Folk Music Society concert series starting Saturday, September 17th. With singer-songwriter Tim Grimm. The folk music series of 9 Saturday concerts starts September 17th and continues through May of 2023 at the Reedwood Friends Church on Southeast Steele. Season tickets are now available. Ticket information can be found at kboo.fm
under community events.